So there we go. The conference is being recorded. His program, which we're calling Supporting, Healing, and Social Justice Through Storytelling. Now, before I introduce Karen, I just want to tell you all that Healing Story Alliance has, we aim to have a storytelling, a teleconference one per month, except in the summer. And we have another one coming up on November 5th, our own Fran Stallings, who you, some of you just heard on the call. And she'll be sharing her program called Stealth Echo Telling, Putting Your Repertory Where Your Mouth Is. And I know that's going to be a wonderful program. And you can go on to our website, healingstory.org, and read more about that. And let's see, just to let you know also that, as you just heard, the program is being recorded. And in about 5 days, it should be on the website. You can go there and either download it directly, or there's a number for how to call in. So I think those are the announcements that I wanted to make. Like some of you I know listening to this call, I was fortunate enough to hear Karen for the first time at our Sharing the Fire conference this past March. And he described some of his work using social justice folklore and storytelling in a wide variety of settings, from bringing together groups affected by sectarian violence and prejudice in Scotland to training high-ups in the military to improve communication. He described his work through the Rotary World Peace Organization, helping homeless people to have a voice through telling their stories. I could spend the whole half hour talking about all the projects that he has been involved with, and you can also go to his website and look for them. The one I'm familiar with is KiranSingSirah.wordpress.com, and if there's another one, Kiran, you can tell us about that as well.
Yeah.
Is that the best one for people to go to?
Probably, yeah. There's the website for it is old. It's not been updated, but there's enough information on there to look at past projects. But if people are interested in some newer stuff that I'm doing or that we are doing as an organization, then just the International Storytelling Center has got we've got like blogs and things like that happening at the moment.
Excellent. Yes, and I should say, if you don't know, that Karen is now the director of the International Storytelling Center. That's really exciting, too. So the last thing I wanted to mention was that in 2012, he was invited to present a talk at the United Nations called Telling Stories That Matter. And so I'm so excited to welcome you, Karen, and we're all giving you a muted but very enthusiastic welcome cheer.
Okay, thank you.
Carry
so
on. Yeah.
All right. So I'm hoping that you guys are still going to be able to hear me and it's not going to cut out. So I'll just keep talking, and I might find that in half an hour I'm still talking and no one's heard me. But yeah, just to thank you all very much for inviting me, and Elisa for inviting me to do this. I thought one of the ways to do this would be just to sort of go through how I see storytelling and how it kind of really affected my life growing up, which was really sort of helped to shape my personal vision about why I think storytelling is such an important vehicle in healing community and bringing communities together. And I was going to sort of maybe start off with kind of growing up in England and then what happened next and what happened next and what happened next until I came to the United States and focused on being a Rotary Peace Scholar and focusing on working through using story to work with people disaffected from society, specifically homeless communities. So I'll do that, and I'm very open to all questions, any type of questions that you have, and I'm I hope for a bit of discussion as well. And excuse me, because I do have a bit of a cold, so I've got a tissue next to me, so I'm going to might keep blowing my nose. Anyway, so here we go. So what I want to sort of start off with is, first of all, I'm going to try and look at a couple of case studies. And I think Elisa picked up on it as really looking at tackling sectarianism work that I kind of initiated and started and kind of led a project in Scotland, which I think really sort of helped to shape my career, but also really make me think about the processes of how we think about storytelling in its diverse form and its broadest sense. But storytelling for me has always been part of my life. Now, I was born in 1976, and I was the son of a refugee family that came from Uganda in 1972. So I always think about it when Jimmy Neal and the National Storytelling Festival happened here in Jonesboro. I wasn't born yet, but something very different was happening to my family in another part of the world. My family were of Indian origin. They grew up in East Africa as migrant workers, and my mum was born in Kenya, my father in India, and my brother was a 6-month-old baby in Uganda, and then I was born in England. But in 1972, they were expelled from the country by the dictator, Idi Amin, along with 60,000 other Asians, basically, Indian or Pakistani minorities. So my family came to Britain. But what they had to do was they had to basically, when you're leaving your homeland, there's very little things that you can take with you. Most of the families were actually robbed on the way to the airports or left very vulnerable. And so they couldn't take any of their possessions. They couldn't take any of their objects. They took very minimal photographs. But what they could take with them was the stories. And these were the stories that helped me growing up in southern England and helped my family and my community in Britain kind of form its sense of itself. And these stories that were kind of passed on to me that I helped to use when I was navigating my place from a very young child, being the first person of color in an all-white town, in an all-white school, and having to sort of deal with being a very visible minority, and using those same stories that I could use those stories to project, well, I come from somewhere and I believe in something and this is what it's about. So I would use those stories as part of to some extent, a survival mechanism. But what I always like to think, going back to that time, that in a way what that was, it was a form of nonviolent communication. It was a way for me to assert my place into society and make sense of my two different worlds that I was living in. The world that was in the home, a traditional Indian household, and right opposite my house was my elementary school, which was a very different world. And so it helped me to kind of shape my sense of place and this between these two different worlds until I could come to a point in my life where actually I could bring those two worlds together, and it helped to shape my sense of identity of who I am. So that's where what happened to me as a very young child. But there are other things that happened. There were situations growing up where it was a height of racism at that time for us, and a lot of violent racism. And there were some incidences where when I was 16 years old and I was walking down the high street in my local town, and two middle-aged men got out the car and they hurled racist abuse at me. They picked me up and they threw me up against the car. But I managed to get away from them. And I ran away. But when the police turned up, he was a frightened boy, 16 years old, didn't quite know what was going on. And I called the police for help. I was the person that got into trouble. I was assumed the culprit and not the victim. And it kind of made me very angry. Now I think about that because the anger kind of was something that was kind of festering inside of me. And it was making me become, a starting point for me becoming sort of marginalizing myself from society. But my dad always said to me that I had two options, that I could either allow my anger to fester or I could get myself an education. And for a family that came from more or less a literate family, to get yourself an education was really a big deal. Can I just check people can hear me? Elise, are you still there?
We can hear you.
Okay, that's good. Cause
you're coming through loud and clear on my phone. This is Joe.
Okay. I can hear you.
Okay, that's great. I just wanted to check this. So that's where I was at age 16. So I ended up becoming a high school teacher, but I became an art teacher. Now, although I trained in visual arts, when you train in the arts, you can use storytelling as an art form. You can understand all different types of art forms when you train as an artist. You learn to see the world from a different perspective, but most importantly, you see the arts as a tool, as a voice for recognition, and as a vehicle to express your thoughts on the world. I then became this high school teacher in North London, and a lot of the young kids that I was working with, and the majority of them were white kids, but a lot of these kids that were either teenage moms or suffering from certain forms of addictions. Some of these kids had not seen their parents for about 2 or 3 weeks. One child tried to take her own life. Yeah, someone might need to mute their thingy because it's making a lot of...
Star six.
Okay.
If you're new to the call, please mute your phone by hitting *6. Thank you. Karen, back to you.
Okay. And so I was obviously at this place in my life. I was 22 years old. 21, 22 years old, and I was really realizing the power of all forms of ways of that when you think about storytelling in its broadest sense, how one particular young girl, she had basically had to leave the high school because she had to have an abortion. But when she came back to the high school, she told me that she had no friends anymore and she was completely lost. So I asked her to explore her own stories, but put it into the form of a visual art piece. And I just found the sort of the power of when you bring people together and allow people to give people a mechanism to express themselves, then the empowerment or the feeling of empowerment that achieves, just like I had growing up as a child. And that particular young girl, she managed to pass her A-levels and graduate from high school, which was that sort of, I realized I was able to make a difference there. So what happened from there was that I moved up to Scotland. Now, I moved up to Scotland in 2001, and to tell you the truth, at that time, I was a little bit kind of lost, didn't quite know where I was going, and I just only had an idea that I was going to work in Scotland for a little while, make a bit of money, and head to South America and go backpacking. I found myself, actually, when I moved to Scotland, I got myself a job at the National Museum of Scotland. Now, this was in September. This was in August, around August 2001. And around that time, I'd been given a platform, an opportunity to basically, I was told by my bosses running an education program, was that use the museum as a bridge between the communities, those that don't come to the museum, the marginalized communities, and the objects and the heritage and what goes on in this museum space. What happened next was 9/11. And so the effects of 9/11 kind of was something that kind of resonated with people all across the world, all that work towards building race relations or a diverse and multicultural society somehow had gone back 30 years. And there was a lot of tension, obviously, everywhere across the world. There was a lot of suspicion and fear. And I found myself talking, and there was around a couple of months after 9/11, back just in Edinburgh in Scotland, a local mosque and a synagogue were both attacked and firebombed. But they weren't attacked by each other. They were attacked by people in the community that were trying to divide people of faith. And so what happened from that point, I literally picked up the Yellow Pages and I phoned every place of worship that I could, from across the Christian denominations to the Muslim denominations to the Jewish denominations to Sikhs and Hindus and Buddhists and Baha'is, except the Brahma Kumaris, and invited people to come into the museum spaces over a six-month period, or did this work to collect for a final event, and encourage people, both leaders of faith, people of the community, to bring in their objects and stand side by side and tell personal stories about what it meant to be a Sikh, a Muslim, a Jew, a Christian, a Catholic, a Protestant, and Scottish, and living in Scotland. It was really a chance to, once you share that sort of personal narrative, but the visible aspect of that, of people coming and sitting side by side and telling their stories. Now, that one event attracted around 6,000 people. And that's not because of the work that I did. It's because I worked for the National Museum of Scotland, so I had a marketing effort behind me and a team of people that could communicate it across, and I had that support. But we had a big open space where we brought people, and we'd looked at stories across many different ways of telling stories, from Coptic Christians that sang songs of resurrection to, you know, Jewish Scots that, you know, sang various different types of music that incorporated both Scottish and Celtic music and the klezmer traditions, to Scottish Buddhists, to asylum seeker refugees, to young children. But the impact of that was they wanted more, because it was a celebratory event and the community wanted to do more. So from that point, the museum, the National Museum of Scotland, established this relationship and through this work with people of faith across Scotland, and so that young people could go to the mosque and then come to the museum, or go to the synagogue and the mosque and then come to the museum and explore faith, but from the personal story. So not this is the five pillars of Islam, but more from a perspective of a young person, a young Muslim Scot living in Scotland. What does it mean to be a Muslim growing up in Scotland today? What does it mean to be Jewish growing up in Scotland today? I didn't call it a storytelling event, but it was a storytelling event. And from that point, I'd kind of embarked on, without realizing it, a kind of defining of a career for myself, where I was asked to move to Glasgow, and I was offered a job in Glasgow in just around 2002. But I was a curator of a museum of religion in Scotland. Now, a museum of religion in a city of 3 million people, where half the city is Catholic and half the city is Protestant, more or less. There's 6,000 Sikhs, about 5,000 Jews, about 30,000 Muslim. And it's a city that is one third of the population below the poverty belt, and around 360 gangs across the city of Glasgow, but also hundreds of years of religious history, and a lot of that quite violent. So in the public realm, you'll see that expression of sectarian violence a lot within sport. The two big soccer clubs, Rangers and Celtic, if you support Rangers, you're a Protestant. If you support Celtic, you're a Catholic. And every time the two teams play, which is about three or four times in a year, somebody dies. Somebody's killed. When I came to Glasgow, now imagine this, I have an English accent. I'm brown. I'm a Sikh. But I'm living in a city which is trying to deal with its sectarian issues. And people said to me, there is no way sectarianism will ever go from this city. It's part of our culture. It will never die. And I said, well, when I grew up in South England, racism was at its height, and I can see the changes of my society, and I know it can change. One is to do with religion, one is to do with race, but if we work together, things can be tackled. So I set up a program called Bigot Busters, which was about busting bigotry. It was a catchy name, but it worked. Initially, it was about working with young people from the museum. I would work in the museum, but I would reach out to the soccer clubs, to all the denominational, non-denominational schools, and encourage young people to come together to hear the stories of people that were victims of sectarian violence. One of those people was a mother of a child called Mark Scott. Mark Scott was a 16-year-old teenager that was killed for wearing a Celtic top, assumed Catholic, and was stabbed to death. But his mother came along and told the story of how it affected her life. And it gave young people a chance to not just hear about the sectarian issues, but kind of share their own experiences of sectarianism in its subtle form and most overt forms within the city of Glasgow. What I'd also encouraged was that if a Catholic school and a non-denominational school could arrange a visit together, they got their trip for free. So they came to the museum, but their group visit was free. That wasn't just a one-off visit. A lot of these kids would use objects, use museum artifacts, and explore these issues that are very much part of their everyday society. Some of that work included working with rival gangs. For example, when I told you that there was around 360 gangs in the city of Glasgow, some of those gangs are named the Shamrock Girls or the Tonya Bass or the Billy Boys, all names that are kind of folkloric expressions to some extent, but names that relate to religious identity, to Irish migration, to the diverse migrant groups that live within the city of Glasgow and its surrounding area, but in pockets of society that are made up in pockets of ethnic groups and different diverse groups. But when they came into the museum, very rarely did these young people have a chance to actually talk to one another. They met each other on the streets of the city of Glasgow, where one side of the street was one territory and the other side was another territory. If you cross the street, you're in trouble. But these were gangs that would meet inside a museum space. And through that process was to unpack, using, again, objects, artifacts, balladry, songs. I collected objects that would relate to the sectarian issues in the city of Glasgow and allowed young people to be open as much as possible and to express their voice. Some of that work was also about working with young people that were first-time offenders. And I managed to encourage or persuade the police force that when a young kid commits a first-time sectarian offense, don't send them to community service to go and paint a railway or paint a wall. Send them to me. That would be their official punishment. So they thought they're getting punished, but what I did was to employ artists to allow them to create projects which were included how they could tell their story to the wider community. So they would work with an artist to create either a painting or a oral history testimony and create multimedia-based exhibitions in the museum space and then invite their peers and then invite other community representatives to come and see their work. But one of the things we used to do was if they did a painting, for example, I would put it alongside and put that painting up on the wall alongside Salvador Dali's Christ of St. John of the Cross, which is an iconic painting by Salvador Dali, the most expensive painting in Scotland. But to see for a young kid that came from Postle Park in Glasgow to see his own work and his own viewpoint on the sectarian issues but displayed alongside this most expensive painting. And it was about giving that validation and that recognition that your voice is very important and important enough to put into a museum and important enough to put in and to be heard. And then politicians, the mayor of the city of Glasgow, will come to these launches. And they may come to a launch of two young teenagers that have gone through the restorative justice program, but it was worth them coming. And so that was an important aspect of that work. A lot of that was also about working with communities affected. So when starting off with young people, but then it moved to working with the Scottish government. And the Scottish government, once the program had become established, and I say that because I'd been a teacher in England, I suppose to some extent when you're an outsider, you come in with a different perspective, but that outsiderness is an opportunity to look at issues that are more related to local communities, but use yourself as a kind of a facilitation bridge between communities that can't walk into each other's spaces. So the fact that my girlfriend at the time was Catholic, but she could not walk into a certain Orange Order center. A member of the Orange Lodge could not go into a place of a specific place of worship for whatever, but I could go into both spaces. And I was welcome in both spaces. So I used that as an opportunity to work in a way that was more about facilitation and bringing communities together. And that led me to working with the Scottish government and a lot of the communities in Northern Ireland that were coming out of a 30-year war, what we call the Troubles. And there was an element of money that had come in from the Peace 2 initiative where communities, leaders of society, whether they were ex-paramilitary members, members of the IRA or members of the UDA or the UVF or the UFF, very, either loyalist or nationalist paramilitary organizations, but they were participating in this work. Alongside them were members of the police force, the army officials, as well as the ecumenical community, members of the Orange Lodges, members of the Roman Catholic Church and the Church of Ireland and the Church of Scotland. And they would come, and just like with working with the young people, they would come out of their particular setting across the water, which is not that far, into the west of Scotland, into Glasgow. And we would use this, again, this museum space to have 2 or 3 days of unpacking what did it mean to grow up during the Troubles during a certain period, and from your perspective, what does it mean to grow up in a specific faith which is, for other people, seen as something that is very anti-Catholic? What does it mean to march down the streets and to assert your religious identity, which might be, for another group, seen as very aggressive or militant? And there was one particular individual, and I think I remember telling Elisa this at the Lanes conference, which really stood out for me, and there was a man from the Orange Order. Now, in Glasgow, we have literally around 90,000 people or so that march through the city of Glasgow asserting a very strong Protestant identity, but it's seen as a kind of anti-Catholic march as to many people. But he came, and he said that just by participating in those 1 or 2 days, his whole faith community, his whole family had disowned him. But he said he's proud to be a member of the Orange Lodge, and he's also proud to be a Christian. And he, from his belief, was that he needed to kind of move out of his comfort zone to establish a more, or help to establish a more peaceful society where he came from, even if that meant that he, when he goes back home, he has no family, or he has no one to worship with. And that really sort of stood out to me. And it's when we kind of bring people together to share those particular stories, what I believe is that you look at the story behind the story. You look at this, you have an opportunity to kind of go behind the narrative arc, and a very powerful narrative arc. Stories have been used to divide our societies as well as bring people together. And I think it's how we use storytelling to be organized, to encourage people to listen, and but also understand that there are also groups and societies and people that have used story to create this block and doesn't allow you in. And this kind of larger narrative arc. And what is important is that that particular story from that man was a story behind the story that broke that narrative. And the more people that got to hear that, when they see the Orange Order, they will think about them differently. I could probably go on and on about that in different ways as well. But I realize I've actually gone quite over time. I've gone more than my time here. I was doing this work, and again, I suppose around now there's around 50, 60,000 people that participate in that work, that it came to a point where I could move on from that. And then I went on, I want to just kind of very briefly move on from that. So I left the museum to work, to run a non-profit organization in Scotland called From Sense Scotland. This is working with people that are born congenitally deafblind, people that are born from birth both deaf and blind, or have complex dual disabilities, where they understanding of the world is from the palm of their hand. And a lot of it's developed through touch communication, social haptic touch communication, or you develop a, not everyone could speak Scottish Sign Language, but you might learn various different ways in which people could communicate through their little toe, and that might be the only mobility they have in their whole body. So that became the place where the story is told, from the little toe. So we would bring maybe 4 or 5 different types of musicians, artists, theatre people to work with one individual from birth up until the age of 35, 40 years old, and it would develop any means necessary using the person's sound or mobility to develop a way for that person to tell their story to the world, whether that's through music, whether that's through creating memories, creating visual arts in some way. We don't really put a label on this is cooking, this is visual arts, this is going to taking your meds, because for a deafblind person, all that experience is one. It was using the arts, and I would train artists to work alongside social workers and social care workers, but to use arts as your primary mode of communication when you're developing communication with people born congenitally deafblind. That was a national program across Scotland, but it also included running the Helen Keller International Award.
Hello, we seem to have lost the signal.
I'm just unmuted, but is that you, Lisa?
This is Fran. I unmuted so that I could talk too, but we seem to have lost the main signal.
Yeah, Lisa, if you can hear me and have Kieran's phone number, that would help us kind of dial in or have him dial in again.
That was pretty
sudden.
This is
Gail. I was kicked off twice before now, even.
Oh, really?
So maybe that's happening to other people, too.
Well, but we're able to talk with one another. Hello?
Yeah.
Well, I guess while we're, I'm going to email him, but Brian, if you want to just give us a reaction or some kind of reflection on Kieran's story, it's kind of awesome in a way to think that you can get 50 or 60,000 people engaged in community by telling their stories, but that's kind of what I heard.
Yes, it was wonderful that he was able to create a kind of neutral ground, and I think his insight that his own identity as not being either the one or the other side allowed him to be a kind of neutral party in between that let him bring in these other people.
Yes, it seems to me that he's a perfect bridge, isn't it, Fran? This is the other Kieran in Australia here. Because he is a person of color, and it's very acceptable for people who are generally suspicious of each other that they can say, okay, he's different. He's not, you know, one of us. He's not one of them.
Yeah. So it allowed him to be kind of like an alien, an outer space alien brokering
mm-hmm.
peace between the nations.
Mm.
So I wonder whether someone who had grown up in the territory, the same territory, would have been able to accomplish something like that. Here's someone. Did someone else come in?
Yes, hi,
oh.
Muriel Horowitz.
Hi, Muriel.
Hi.
Jeannie Donato in Rhode Island.
Oh,
we
hi.
We seem
how
to have lost.
Yeah, I just saw, I thought it was too late. I didn't remember what time you guys started.
Well, we started about on the hour, but we've lost the main signal. We don't have
yeah.
Allison or Kieran, either one.
Oh.
So I was just...
Who else is here?
This is Fran Stallings in Oklahoma. So I was trying to get some discussion of what we had been hearing from Kieran, who did amazing things in Scotland. Hello?
Yeah, his story was remarkable in that he makes it sound like it was easy, but there are some things of real fortune and good chance here, because he wound up in a place that was open to addressing the conflict and diversity in the community. And he had enough understanding of some method of social organization that by inviting people to come to the table, I'd love to hear a little bit more about how he kind of got the word out. but just having people then come and tell a story and have it listened to seems to be the connection. I mean, it was there any other moving parts on it?
He said he had artifacts of some sort, and he had people do,
hello?
He had some of the teenagers make artwork.
Hello?
Back in?
Yes.
There.
Is that
sorry.
You, Kieran?
Yeah, it completely...
Kieran, did we scare you away?
Yeah, what? I don't know what happened. Sorry, it went dead. It suddenly just cut out. So I just had to call back in again and go through the access code thing. And so I'm sorry about that.
No, that's okay. We got you where you were talking about the NGO which dealt with the congenital disabilities and getting musicians and artists, social workers to help, you know,
to help them
communicate, yeah, with whatever ability they did have. That's where you kind of left.
That was good there, because that was around the point where I think it cut out. So, I realized, I'll try and skip forward from there and just tell you a bit, very briefly, because I know we can open up the questions as well. From that point, I was offered a Rotary, what's called a Rotary World Peace Scholarship, where Rotary identify around 10 people from different parts of the world to come to the United States, but also other peace centers across the world. And at any one year, there's 50 of us in different parts of the world. And so I came to the United States in 2011, and I'd been the first person to come from the arts, really, to do this work. But I focused on folklore and international development, but specifically looking at the role of story. And I focused my work. I was looking for focused my work working with people that had experienced or moving from place to place, moving from home to home, but had found themselves living in a homeless shelter. But really, what I was looking at is the concept of how people claim a sense of home through story. And so it was really about looking at the role that story plays in when you do what's called, like, I suppose, this term dialogical ethnography, is when you use a type of ethnography that's based on conversation and dialogue. When you start sharing story, you come to a place where that story overlaps, and then you and your consultant can move into forming a new story together. And so that was where I did that work for about 2 years, and I recorded the stories of around 15 men living in homeless shelters. But one of the approaches that I did was collecting stories, but then working with my consultants to transcribe those stories and put it into the form of poetics, into theater, into slam poetry. So I do collaborative slam poetry with my consultants. So these are homeless men. And we would, rather than just take their story and put it into an academic journal, which I didn't believe in doing, was taking the story and working again with the consultant and turning it into a piece of theater. And where the two people, and so therefore what the whole point was is that it wasn't owned by me, it was Shirley owned. And then they could take their own story and present it to the world in any which way they wanted to as an artist. Not so the label is not, I'm not a homeless man, I'm an artist, I'm a storyteller, I'm a poet, I'm a theater person, I'm a writer. And that was the point where it was about using their own story, but kind of giving it back to them in a different format and working in a way that was, like me, I used story as a young child as a way to, you know, access resources, to fight racism, and to find my place in society in the same way it was about using story in this process to enable these men to be able to use their own story to find as a survival mechanism for themselves, but also establish their place in society beyond the label of stigma of homelessness. So that's where I'm at. And then obviously after that work, the fellowship, I got offered a job in Jonesboro. That's another story.
That's great. Can you hear me, Kieran? It's Elisa.
I can. Yeah.
Oh, good. I think maybe this is the time, thank you so much, for us to ask you questions. I know when you were gone, we were starting to talk about it, and so why don't we see who would like to jump in with a question?
Kieran here. I'm interested in, you mentioned artifacts that, this was in Glasgow, yeah? Artifacts that you got the people to bring in, whether it was gangs or whoever they were, to meet in the museum with artifacts, and I was interested in that. What kind of artifacts would they be?
Well, they ranged actually from a whole range of stuff. Actually, I would use artifacts. One of the artifacts I used was actually toilet tissue paper with poetry written on it, a very small piece of toilet paper, almost like the size of, less than the palm of your hand, a prison-issued toilet paper that was written on by a Republican, I mean, this is Irish Republican, not Republican American, Irish Republican hunger striker called Bobby Sands. And he's a romantic figure, a hero within the nationalist movement in Northern Ireland. His pictures on murals on the walls. And he wrote poetry when he was doing a hunger strike. He died in prison on a hunger strike. And that particular piece of poetry was smuggled out of the prison. It was put into a condom. It was put in someone's body parts and then managed to find itself outside of the museum and eventually found its place on a museum display, but it was kept in storage for many, many years until the point came where it could be open to the public and people had the chance to come and talk about it. The power of a mundane object that tells a story. Other objects included objects that I would go out and actually collect myself. There was one of the things I used to do. I would go to the soccer games when the two teams were playing, and there were people that were selling sectarian merchandise. Merchandise that basically had like posters that said the Celtic football team, we are God's chosen people. So you can see how religion came into things. Objects like potatoes that were thrown onto the fields to mock the Irish migrants. Pepperami sticks that are turned into crucifixes. So they use crucifix to mock the other side. So you can see how religion was embedded in sport in Scotland. And then two objects which included songs and contemporary songs. Like there's a song called "Hello, Hello, We Are the Billy Boys. We're up to our knees in Fenian blood. Surrender your die." A song that is chanted at football games in the streets, but a very, very sectarian loaded song. And it was about unpacking that stuff, unpacking the actual what a Fenian meant, what who was the Billy Boys, and looking at local Glasgow history, but also history that went back since the Reformation period. So, and then two objects where I would, one Muslim woman, we talked when I was doing the work in Scotland, she donated her hijab. And why? Because after 9/11, the Muslim Association of Britain said, be careful walking through the streets wearing identity that identifies you as a Muslim, because Muslims will be attacked. And so what she did, and her husband said to her, be really careful, maybe you shouldn't wear your hijab. And she goes, I'm going to wear my hijab because it's my identity and I'm very proud to wear my hijab. So she donated her hijab to the museum so it could be talked about in that way. Actually, my dad donated his kirpan, which is the Sikh sword. Another man donated his Rastafarian hat, a turban. You know, so people would bring contemporary objects as well as, you know, objects that were meaningful to them that they could use as a catalyst to talk about.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
You're on. It's Elisa. You just at the very end, you were talking about helping these men who were living in the shelter, and you said that you would start sharing and find a place where your stories overlapped, and that would kind of allow the telling to begin. Could you speak just a little bit more about that?
Sharon, did we lose you?
Oh, no.
Bummer.
Hey. Oh, my gosh.
Well, he'll come back. That was a heck of a question, Elisa. That was just a wonderful question.
Oh, sent him away.
Oh, dear. Maybe he can record it, and then we can listen to it later.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Look, it's in Australia. It's 1 o'clock practically, and I do have a lunch appointment, so I'm going to have to say goodbye to all of you.
Well, it was great to meet you.
Yeah. Okay, bye, everyone.
Bye.
Bye. Thanks.
Yeah, I'm trying to picture...
I'm back.
Using
sorry.
This,
you're back
this
again.
Technique
well,
here.
Well,
here in
Sharon's
the
back, I think.
Back?
Yep.
Sorry, it just keeps cut. It cut out just by itself. I don't know why it does that. I'm really sorry about that. But I can take up where you, when you asked.
Elisa had a great question.
Yeah.
Did you hear my question?
I did. Yeah, I did.
Okay.
So that part, the overlapping, was... It was when I initially started working with the homeless community. I came in as a volunteer, but we would find places where we could meet on equal ground. So many of these places were not the setting where you start sharing stories. I found were in these peripheral spaces, these kind of liminal spaces, these spaces where you're even neither there. In their space or your world, but a space in between. One example of that is the front porch. A front porch is an amazing liminal space where you're neither inside nor outside. You're going from one state to another state. And it's in those states where, in those that liminal space where you're, where the conversation and story swapping becomes a great space for sharing. And so we found spaces. These could be spaces where we'd sit on the front porch of the homeless shelter. They had these little enclave shelter spaces. We found park benches where we would meet. There was one man called Johnny where I kept asking him questions about his experiences of homelessness, but what I was doing was I was looking for a specific answer, and I wasn't listening to him properly. And after he started telling me about the mountains of North Carolina and the Black Mountains, what he was telling me, he was answering my question, but doing it through revealing a memory, a story of where he came from. And then I started relating to that because I started talking about the mountains of Scotland, where I'd come from. And so we found a place where we were both kind of refugees. We were both living in a new place, but we'd come from somewhere else. We'd both grown up with home cooking. We could remember the smells of our mothers cooking growing up as children. And so what we were doing, I wasn't just going in there cold and collecting a story, but we were relaying stories to each other. And through that relationship and exchange, where this dialogical exchange that kept going back and forth, and then we were coming to a place where we were making a connection with one another. And so every time we met, our friendship got stronger. And stronger to a sense where we had these experiences that we could share with one another. And so our stories were kind of intertwined in that sense.
Beautiful. Yeah.
Kieran, when you first started in Scotland with the group that you said grew to some 50,000 to 60,000 people, can you help us with what the invitation was to come together and share stories? Was it just the mechanism of the invitation from the museum to do this? Were there social groups concerned with violence or anything helping you? What was the invitation like?
Let me interrupt right here. We're getting a lot of feedback. If we could please just remind people, because it's been recorded. Can you, after you ask your question or whoever, can you just, *6 would be great. Thanks so much.
So it was different for different projects. I would say that the greatest amount of the work was the pre-work that we did, the relationship building. And that was I mean, I spent a lot of time going out and giving talks or meeting rabbis, imams, but it was very important to what we call like breaking down a museum wall was to, you can never expect people to come to you unless you're willing to go to them first. And so it was, I would go and give talks. I would go and meet people in their spaces. I would go and the rabbi would take me to the synagogue, but then show me how the history of the three different waves of Jewish migration that came to Scotland both before and after the war, and how they built this shelter next to the synagogue to accommodate a different ethnic group or a different language-speaking Jewish community, knowing that over time the two communities will become one. And they built these two separate synagogues next to each other. And that was how one community supported the other. So a lot of it was going out and talking to people, setting up consultation groups. One particular project was when it took about 3 years to develop into one exhibition. And that was to work with a project called African Voices of Scotland. And so I spent probably around 3 years working and going into community spaces, from churches to mosques to meeting artists to meeting refugee communities, asylum groups, and talking one-to-one, bringing them into the museum collections, going back into the museum stores and finding objects that came from Zimbabwe, for example. And this person was of the Shona community and these objects related to Zimbabwe, or to working with a Ghanaian pastor working in Scotland and going back into objects that came from Ghana or Liberia. And so that process was, you know, it was very, very kind of hands-on, but it was about, again, about establishing these relationships over a period of time and then asking the community to then reach out to their own members of their own groups. One of the things is I was also on the steering committee, the Refugee Council for Scotland. So I would do work and use those resources. I also worked with GARA, Glasgow Anti-Racist Alliance. And I was also on the board for the African Caribbean Society. And so I was also doing work beyond my official work to welcome in all the about 30,000 asylum seekers coming into Glasgow, but mainly from the African continent. And so I was already doing, and I work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. This wasn't just a job, you know what I mean? So when you work, you build these relationships, and I'd say the bigger busters work, that was stuff that we didn't have to really market. You know, once you started and doing this work, the word spread, and then you would get awards, like Her Majesty's Inspectorate for Education came and assessed the program, gave it the seal of approval. I'm not particularly big supporter of the Queen, but what the Queen did do, Her Majesty's Inspectorate, was give it Her Majesty's approval and recommended all Scottish schools to take part, which then meant that with the teaching councils, the word spread across the teaching council, and the teaching councils for Scotland said to schools across Scotland, participate in this work. So it's a very multi-leveled approach of reaching out to the community. There's no one way of marketing, if you want to market it or communicate the essence of what you're doing. But I think an element of it is that, you know, depending on what you really want to achieve, I think it's kind of working from within the community and trying to find it, come to a place where it's an equal meeting to some extent. I'm not sure if I really answered that very well. I'm sorry.
Better than well, Kieran. Better than well.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Anybody else?
I don't have a question, but I do just want to say what a phenomenal thing that I think it is when what I heard you saying was that building trust first in the communities,
yeah,
the different communities. As an outsider, really, you were an outsider going in. It wasn't somebody from within that community, but rather an outsider who went in, took that chance, and then you took the work or whatever, and you showed it at a neutral place, and then at some point, different communities could come together. And I just think that's a phenomenal approach, and I just commend you for that.
Thank you very much. I think that's, I've been thinking a lot. When I first came to the United States, there's someone I really respect called Elaine Lawless, and she's a professor of folklore, does a lot of work with collecting stories of women experience domestic violence. And she first said to me when I first came to the United States, and she said, you're in a quite a unique position because you're a man of color, but you have a British accent, and you can navigate between different worlds in this country, and there's a lot of conversations that people in this country need to deal with and still have, and they're not having it. And one thing that she said is that so many anthropologists and folklorists and sociologists go and study the other. They go and study Italian-American or the Lithuanian-American, or they go to Papua New Guinea, but who studies America? And as an outsider, what you can do as an outsider artist, whether you're a storyteller, a collector, a folklorist, an ethnographer, is that you can use that outsiderness to bring or to help a community to see itself in a certain way, not to impose your views, but to bring people together and have a conversation with one another. And since thinking about that, you know, I started to do a little bit of work looking at an organization called Coming to the Table, which is working with descendants of enslaved people and descendants of slaveholders, recognizing the fact that slavery as an institution or as an idea is still an issue that the American public needs to grapple with and hasn't quite come to terms with that. So that was an interesting project. And so that's run by the Mennonite University. I think we're all outsiders in different ways, is how we kind of use that outsiderness. And I'm in East Tennessee.
And you're in East Tennessee.
I'm open to any. I hope that answered the question. But if I'm open to any other questions,
this is Jeannie Donato in Rhode Island. My comment is that you've found the common ground, and that is what allowed the story to bypass the freeze or flight fight part of the brain of the homeless and of the people having their intercultural problems, and have story work its wonders through the emotion. And I think you did a wonderful job.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Thank you so much.
Kieran, Mike Seliger from New York.
Hello.
You had mentioned using rap poetry as one way of enabling...
Mike, you cut out. Sorry, can you just repeat that question? Sorry.
Can you hear me now?
I can hear you perfect, yeah.
Okay. You had mentioned rap poetry as a way of getting people to have ownership of a way of presenting who they were in their own stories. Were there other mechanisms like that that you also used, or is that the main one?
No, there were others. There was a the reason I mentioned that, because I'm a slam artist, a slam poet, so it's a form of, I mean, there's a lot of men in the homeless shelter. I would get there at 6 o'clock in the morning, or sometimes I'll sleep in the shelter itself as a resident. But, you know, there's a lot of culture. Some of the men I worked with were African-American, and there's a culture of ciphering or joning, you know, when you create a circle and it's almost like competitive story speak, where you exchange it. And so it's utilizing that method, but you also want to be able to, I use that art form because it's the art form that I knew, but another art form, I ran a writing club in the homeless shelter, and the writing club, one thing I did was a process called, I don't know if you know, ethnopoetics, and it's a process where you record someone's story, and then when you transcribe that story, you listen to it probably about 20, 25 times. And you transcribe it in a way that is, you try to get it to a point where it's like the way that it was told. folklorists have been doing that for a long time when they've tried to collect stories in this country and Native American stories and et cetera, understanding that, you know, the way you might read someone's story is different, but what you try to do is try to emphasize the way that it was told. So you create a code, like you, if someone speaks elaborately or was with strength, then you put that in bold, or you might use italics. But what I did, I would put it into the form, when I transcribed someone's story, I almost put it to the form of using poetic. So I'd lay it out like a poem, and I used different colors, and I presented it in a way back to my consultant that it, when he looked at it, he goes, oh, this is what I said. This is exactly what you, this is what you said, but it may not be exactly what you said, but this is what you said. And they saw their own speech, their own thing that they said, presented in a way that was like a piece of theater, you know, a theatrical, a script for a play. Mm-hmm. And my, when I realized that, I remember giving it back to one guy that I was working with. And then when I went back into the writing group, well, he just kind of took the piece of the script and he goes, this is my story. And he didn't ask anyone. He just took total ownership over that. And that was a very special moment for me, because that I realized that, you know, you can use these processes to give back someone's story. But you do you, the way you present that story to them.
Right.
And
okay.
We don't necessarily recognize in our own voice, you know?
Mm.
It's almost like saying what you have to say is really beautiful, and what you have to say is really special and is really unique. And the way you say it is so unique, and you might notice something that no one else notices, and it's like recognized and giving that and framing it and giving it back.
It's almost like giving somebody back their soul.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'd say so, yeah.
Wow. Pretty powerful stuff here, and I really appreciate you spending the time, and I, part of me wants to go on forever, but it's past the hour. Elise, are you on board still? I guess not. Well, let me thank you, and we will get this recording up, and we'll keep you in the loop. Look forward to any other connections down the road.
Lovely. Thank you so much for inviting me to participate
right.
in that. Look forward to
thank you, Kieran.
Thank you very much. And lovely to speak to you all.
Thank
you.
Good cheer.
All right. Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye now.
Bye-bye. Thank you.